Welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv. Now today we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic, and it's something that comes up all the time, particularly if you're an active property investor. And that is, what do you do when, you know, you might be into a few deals, you've got your money invested in a deal that may not be completed yet, and you've got some other money invested in long-term holds. What do you do when you keep finding deals? Because that's generally the case. What happens is you end up, you know, you might go through a phase to start with where there's no deals out there, nothing works, my FISOs don't work, there's no deals, I can't find any. And then you get your head in the right spot and, oh my goodness, there's all of these deals coming. I actually had that experience with one of my property games kids that I'm mentoring. I've got seven property games kids aged between 18 and 22 that I'm working with over a nine-month period and see what they can accomplish in 9 months. Now, 9 months isn't a long time. So, of course, they go through the emotional roller coaster of, oh, my goodness, I can't find a deal. There aren't any deals out there. None of the feasibilities work, you know, woe is me kind of stuff. And then, you know, you shake them upside down and you get their head in the right spot and bingo, amazingly, all of these deals start coming and they find the feasibilities work and all of these things. It's got nothing to do with whether there was deals out there before or not. It's all to do with their own attitude and their own headspace, basically. So let's say you're in the right headspace and, you know, you're finding all of these deals, but your money's run out. You end up having to, pass up on these deals. Is that what you have to do? Well, in actual fact, it's not. And today, that's what I want to talk about. And I have my dear friend and a student who's been with me for years and years and years. I can't even count how long. She's a developer herself. She's got an amazing track record. And her name is Helena Farrell from Perth. Hey, Helena, how are you?
Hi, Dimpner. I'm good, thank you.
Very good. Now, your companies, you've got two main companies that you work through, being Property Passions and what's the other one called?
And Total Development Solutions.
Total Development Solutions. So obviously, you know, development and properties and things are your game. And development chews up a lot of money. You know, that's a given. When you're developing, it's a lot of money out for a long period of time before any money comes back in. But the rewards can be very, very significant when you allow it, you know, when you finish the deal and that's where all the money comes in. So obviously for you, now you do a lot of developments yourself, but you also do developments as joint ventures, don't you?
Yeah, a lot of what we do is joint ventures, definitely, because of the cash outlay required on projects, basically, that are, you know, over, once you get into middle to high dollar value, you always need other people's money in deals.
Yeah. So I was just chatting to you before there about a deal that you bid at auction, and your limit was, I think, 3 to 3.1 million. And you exercised your ability to pull out of that value because it actually went over that, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. There was one person who came in right at the last minute and he just went, you know, bid for bid. And, in the end, I was like, no, I had to let it go. The capital raise was going to get too high for the level that I was after, really, at the end of the day. It wasn't the profit. Ironically, the profit was extremely high.
Yeah.
And even at 3.1, it would have made a very, very very healthy profit. It's just that Perth's still a quiet market. There's always risk involved with the end sale and having so much capital outlaid, and when the extension of time runs out because of that, I just didn't want to take that risk.
No, fair enough. So let's talk about that. We talk about the Perth market being flat. Now, this is a wonderful thing about education because, you know, a lot of people, they make money in real estate, but they really make money in real estate because they buy something and the market moves with them and it goes up in value. They're no hero, let me tell you. And most people think that that's the only way that you make money in real estate. In fact, they buy properties specifically for that kind of purpose. And that's, you know, it's a sales technique by real estate agents. Say, oh, this is a growth area and whatever else. Well, it may or it may not be. But the trick to being a really successful property investor, of course, is not relying on the market and making money regardless of what the market's actually doing. And in order to do that, you've actually got to be doing some type of manufactured growth. Now, you know, that could be something as simple as a renovation or a subdivision or a strata title or a rezone or, you know, all of these things. Or it could be, you know, something like a development, which is what Helena's involved in. So you've, you know, you're obviously dealing in a flat market over there at the moment, although I do think it's turned a little bit. What, you know, what do you find you need to look for in site selection in a flat market?
Okay, site selection, the main criteria. I've changed what we've been doing for the last couple of years because things have slowed off. It's, first of all, days on the market in the suburb that you're looking for is really important. But days on the market for the product you're wanting to produce is the important part, not what you're buying. The other thing is, for us, because we have the ability, I've got an architectural firm in-house with all project management, everything in-house, and we have experience and we're comfortable at handling high-end boutique type of developments, particularly architecturally designed houses, because that's what we do in-house easily. So for us, it's a boutique end market as well, you know, something that there's not a lot of demand for, but there is a there's not a lot of supply, not demand. There's a lot of demand, but very little supply. So something very niche for us works. So really, days on market for suburb and supply and demand of your end product, really, to be honest, that's really what it comes down to. I'm looking at what people want to buy at the moment and producing what they want to buy.
Let's look at that for you, because you do a lot of high-end luxury stuff. How do you assess that there's a demand for that type of product?
Well, I guess I work in areas that I'm familiar with. So I look at real estate agents, RP data. RP data is actually, that sort of thing's often difficult because you can't really ascertain end values very easily. So a lot of that is real estate agents, how many people are looking for what you're wanting. A big downsizer area is another big thing, where you've got an area that is limited in the ability to build something modern and new and upmarket, but the general demographics are high. So I'm producing a product which is just above the median price of the suburb, but it's a small site, smaller house, very modern, very architectural, but location. It's in the best location for that demographic. Yeah, it's hard. You do take a punt in that you don't know 100%, obviously. You're not going to know exactly how quickly you can sell something. You're just making assumptions based on all your research and statistics. Other ones are purely days on the market, like in Perth, Subi, Shenton Park, have been very popular in that they've snapped up very rapidly. There's not a lot of development capability there, so in that area I'm doing more renovations. So I've gone back to renos, believe it or not.
Because,
yeah, they're making money in certain areas right now.
Right.
And they're quicker than, they can be quicker than a new build, and they're quicker to get through council often, unless you're going to do something stupid, which we don't do. New builds, if I can subdivide, work. Mm-hmm. But certain suburbs won't allow subdivision that make the money that I'm looking at. So, yeah, if I can happen to, you know, get a subdivision site in one of those two suburbs, I'll jump on it in 2 seconds later if it was available. Yeah.
So it's niche marketing. You're looking at the strategies that work at the time. And I think, you know, one of the strategies that I teach is grid variance analysis, which is one of the key fundamentals to identifying what areas you're going to make the most money out of and then, you know, what strategies are actually going to work. So identification of the site. Let's talk about the process of what happens if you've got all your money tied up in other deals and you haven't got the money to, you know, to purchase an amazing site that you found that you're going to make a squillion dollars on. What do you do? Now, that's something that you and I have had many discussions on over the years. And it's really about being market ready. I mean, obviously, you've got to do all your market analysis and all of those things and due diligence and feasibilities on the site and all of that stuff. But you need to have a structure ready. And one of the things that you will need to do is to have, you know, a structure ready to put on a contract, because if it's a good site and it's not going to auction, or if it is going to auction, if it's a good site, there's going to be interest in it, which means you need to put your foot on the deal very, very early. This was, again, something I was talking to my property games kids about, the fact that, you know, they'd missed a couple of really good deals because they weren't market ready, they didn't have a structure ready, and they weren't game enough to go and whack a contract on something with, you know, obviously you've got to have the outs of due diligence and finance clauses and things like that to be able to get out of it if it doesn't work. But on initial feasibilities, just to be able to put your foot on the deal and secure the site, because then all the real nitty-gritty quoting on this and that can actually be done. And even if you have to go back and renegotiate the purchase price after you've signed a contract, that's very doable. But it's too late if you go and do all of this work to get everything ready and all your ducks in the row and everything else, and then somebody comes in and puts a contract on, you know, an afternoon before you. So putting your foot on the deal is very important. Now, the structures to do that, look, I find it easier to probably have something that's flexible to be able to transfer. Let's look at Helena's case. Let's say she bought that place at auction, and she bought it for $3 million. Now, she's got to raise money to do that. So let's say, you know, you had one person putting in $1.5 million and two people putting in $750 each, just as an example, we'll say, to put the money up. Well, she's got to have a structure to be able to accommodate those people coming into the deal, which means that the first thing is she'd have to do the feasibility and make sure that her share is taken care of. So let's say she's taking 40% or 50% or something like that of the end profit for finding the site, project managing the site, you know, architecturally designing the site, doing the designs, all of that kind of stuff. Let's say she's taking 50%. That means that there's 50% of the ownership of the entity that you're setting up needs to be owned by these three other people, but they're not putting in equal amounts of money. So what you need to do is proportionately adjust the ownership of that other 50% to the three people in proportion to the money that they're actually putting in. Now, that can be done through a special purpose company. It could be done through a unit trust. It could be done through a hybrid trust. There's a number of different structures that can actually be used to make that happen. But the real message, I guess, for me here is not what exact structure to use, because that does vary on a number of circumstances, but more so that you've got to be market ready. So Helena would have a structure ready at all times to be able to contract on a property, which initially would totally be owned by her personal structures. But upon purchase and settlement of the property, depending on who comes into the deal, she can then allocate either shares or units to those parties in proportion to the profits that they're actually going to get. So that's very, very important when you're talking about joint ventures. Now, Helena, talk to me about some of the other things that are important, things like, you know, communication and FISOs and things like that.
Yeah, I guess basically your feasibility has to be at a professional level. So it has to cover everything and be very, very clear. So, just a really rough spreadsheet with half your stuff missing isn't good enough. GST has to be accommodated for entirely on there, because, you know, as a developer, when you're starting to get into projects where you're doing them regularly, it's your business, and you will pay GST and you will pay, you know, everything else. It's just what it is. So professional FISOs, professional information packages for people that you're approaching. So put together a proposal, include everything, like an information memorandum. I mean, it would have to be as detailed as if you were going to take it to, you know, a group of people, not necessarily a syndicated one, because that's got a lot more financial data that you wouldn't need, but it has to have everything about the suburb and be professionally, the property and be professionally presented. That includes a lot of stuff. On top of that, when you're there, you've also, outside of all of this, before you actually raise the money for the project that you're doing, you actually have to have enough money to pay a deposit for the property that you're going to be purchasing. So either you get people involved up front, they agree to put a certain amount of money in a bank account that sits there to go towards the deposit when a property arises. Now, that's something different. Or you've got your own cash, you put the cash in for the deposit and you're covered. So you have to consider that as well, because you can't just rock up at an auction, bid, and then on the hammer, you're supposed to put down maybe 20, 30, 40,000, depending on what it is, and you don't have it. So you've got to think about that. You also have to think about how you're going to advertise to people to get money. You know, what are you going to offer them? What returns are you able to offer them as the project? So when you're doing what Dibna says, working out how much money it makes and how much you're apportioning them, you have to give them a return. So, you're better off. I've found it easier to give people a cash on cash return, so basically their investment return based on the cash they invest. That's pretty clear to most people, because project returns and cash returns don't always equate. They're not the same. They're quite different. And I don't know. What else, Gimna?
Well, I think one of the biggest things once you're into the deal is communication and professional communication on a regular basis, as well as full disclosure up front with, you know, very accurate feasibilities, because, you know, you would be reporting at least monthly, if not, you know, more so with your investors on deals, because you need to, you know, they need to know what's happened with their money. They're putting money up into a deal and trusting you.
Yeah, very true. So you set up a system where you, you know, you report. The other thing is, once it gets into construction, we also have a PCG meeting, a project meeting every month with the builder. And from that project meeting, you know, minutes are raised on everything. You know, we take photos of the project and send it out to our joint venture parties. Mm-hmm. So it also just depends on the project and what it is. If it's straight cash investment at a fixed return, and they're just quiet investors that have just put cash in to get a fixed amount of money, they don't necessarily care to be notified about the project. They're just more interested in their return. If it's an investor who's a joint venture partner, particularly ones that want to learn and want to get to know how to do it themselves, we're happy to do that on projects. You know, we check if people are in Perth, they can come on site, they can come into our office and actively help work on the project. I'll give them jobs to do and go get this, go check that, go check this, go check that, and they learn as they go. So it's all communication, you know. At a professional level, you must communicate with your joint venture partners and let them know what's happening. And also when things don't go according to plan, you know, you might not get something that you had expected because things aren't really approved the way that they had been previously. So you keep people in touch with what's happening and timelines and everything else, because once they've made an investment, you know, it's for a period of time. So if that period of time's been extended for any given reason, you know, they should be notified about that.
The other thing, of course, is, you know, through the project, you mentioned it there before about learning, and a lot of people like to go into a joint venture to start with because they learn the process. But it's also very important up front, before you even buy the property, to make sure you've got the joint venture agreement in place, because that will clearly stipulate who does what happens if, you know, things go wrong, what happens if they don't sell, what happens if it makes a loss, you know, who puts in the money if it makes a loss. It's all very well to get all caught up about profits, but what happens if it actually makes a loss? What happens then? You know, and time frames and all of these other things. And the numbers of joint ventures that I've seen that have gone wrong have all come from situations where a joint venture agreement was not put into place. So a joint venture agreement was not signed, and even sometimes that's between parties that are, you know, relatives, like sisters, I've seen don't talk to each other for 20 or 30 years because a joint venture went wrong. So sad and so silly. So, you know, make sure you've got that joint venture agreement in place before you hand over your money or before you sign a contract on anything.
Yeah, the other thing is up front, if you don't have a joint venture agreement done yet because you're waiting for something specific to come up, you can still sign it before you have that. At least get an MOU. I have an MOU with interested parties.
Just to connect
them in and get it.
Just for clarification there, you're doing a bit of jargon there. A memorandum of understanding.
Memorandum of understanding. Basically, it's a couple of pages, very simple, outlines in layman's terms what you're proposing. You know, I am proposing to purchase properties within this range or purchase a property within this price range. It will have a minimum return of X amount of percentage on the project. I offer the future investors X amount of or this investor X amount. You make it between the party you're talking to and yourself, or your company and their company, your trust and their trust. And you basically outline that this is what is expected, and this will be our role, this will be your role, and just generally what it is, and you're both on the same page. And you sign that as a commitment to go forward and invest. And that's really where you can then get more confident that you've got commitments from various people that want to invest in the project with you. and you can go forward from that point in time. And then you have a JV drawn up on the basis of your memorandum of understanding.
Yeah, very good. Okay, Helen, well, I'm sure that's a great food for thought there for everybody, thinking about doing deals and doing joint ventures and getting structures in place and all of those sort of things. And I think the big key here is treat it like it's your money, because it's all very well to risk your own money, but when you're dealing with somebody else's, you really have to make sure that everything is exactly as it's going to be. You know, research has to be greater. Your due diligence must be better, because, you know, you're playing with other people's money. And, well, not so much playing, that's a bad choice of words, but you know, you're dealing with other people's money into a deal. So even more so, the more care needs to be taken when you're doing a joint venture. And of course, the profits need to be higher, because a deal might be good enough to do yourself with your own money, but when you have to split the profits, the profit needs to be bigger in order to make it beneficial for both parties to actually come in and share in the profits. So that's something to consider with joint ventures as well.
Yeah, and the other thing that we haven't mentioned at all, which I think is really important, it's a vital one, is get to know, you know, speak to the people with the joint venture, particularly if they're actively involved in the joint venture and everything else. You know, talk to them and get to know them, because the reality is you have to get along with the people that you're working with. So, you know, don't just go with somebody because they're going to be putting money into a project. If you're really not, if they're really uncomfortable, if they're going to be not difficult, but not comfortable or happy with how the whole thing is set up or would proceed, or they're not comfortable with another person controlling, you know, basically having a reasonable amount of control of the project, which then their money has gone into, if there's not a huge trust level with them, it can cause grief. So you've got to think about, I'm going to be working with this person for a given period of time, and it's going to be at least 12 months to 2 years. How is it going to go in the future? You know, am I prepared to do that, and are they going to be a good fit, both of you? Are you both going to be a good fit for it?
Yeah, very, very, very good point there, because relationships are so important. Everybody thinks that, you know, property is a game you can play sitting behind a computer, and it's so not. It is so much about people, and it's a people business, and, you know, having relationships with agents, relationships with trades, relationships with your joint venture partner. Relationship is everything. So make sure that, you know, you've got that sound basis to be able to work from. Well, thank you, Helena, for coming on the call again today. You're always a source of huge amount of information for everybody, and everyone loves to listen to you. So thanks very much for coming on.
No, thank you. It's been fun. It's good to have a chat and just discuss things that we're all going to be involved in, definitely.
That's exactly right. And don't forget, everybody, to make sure that you go on and give me a rating, give me some comments on iTunes, and I'll be randomly selecting people to send out some books to for their comments and things that they're putting on there. And if you like them, please recommend all your friends. Get them to subscribe to iTunes so that the podcasts come out on a regular basis, because one of the important things is keeping your head in the right spot. And a great way to do that is to constantly feed it with positive, knowledgeable, accurate information that really fuels your own thought processes to get out there and be more intuitive, more creative, and more make more money. So that's it for me, guys. Thank you so much for being on the line. And again, thank you, Helena, for coming on with me. And I'll be back again to talk to you very, very soon on another completely different topic. So talk to you soon, guys. Bye for now.